Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Good evening. Welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. My name is Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
So today we're going to talk about the Kabbalah. And this is probably the first of two shows because we need to kind of lay the foundation to eventually talk about the Kabbalistic alchemists. And also, especially maybe, even the Christian Kabbalah and the influence on Lullianism and Lullian alchemists that you know, this whole tradition kind of builds upon. So to break down Kabbalah a little bit, it's basically an esoteric tradition, so kind of like a mystic tradition that grew out of Jewish communities. Now, it's not a religion itself, so not all Jews are Kabbalistic. In fact, sometimes it can be seen as a heresy, but it did come out of these Jewish traditions, so they do have the Torah and Talmud and all those things as a foundation. And it kind of emerged out of esoteric traditions that, you know, even predate the Kabbalah itself. Let's say around the 12th to 13th century in like southern France and Spain. And it also gained momentum or took on a kind of new aspects in the 16th century in Ottoman-controlled Palestine when they started to focus on looking for when the long-awaited Messiah would finally come. Okay, especially around the town of Safed. So there's, you know, we're spanning a great deal of time here. And then, like I said, there was Christian Kabbalah and many offshoots. So we're not going to get into all aspects of the Kabbalah, but we'll give you an overview and try to keep it short because there is more to come that actually ties into alchemy more directly. A follower is called a Mekubal. And if you ask a Mekubal, they would tell you that Kabbalah is ancient knowledge passed down by tzaddikim, which means righteous people, and I hope I didn't butcher that, and the knowledge that eventually led to all religion, science, art, political thought, etc. We've heard the same kind of philosophy before, like in things like even Neoplatonism and Hermeticism and that kind of thing, that there's this knowledge that leads to all wisdom.
You know, according to Zohar, the fundamental text of Kabbalistic thought is a book that we've used for research on the show. The Torah study can proceed along with four levels of interpretation. These four levels are called pardes, from their initial letters P-R-D-S, as in Hebrew would be orchard. So maybe the growth of knowledge is where that might come from. So let's take a look at some of these four parts. Peshat in Hebrew is known as simple, the direct interpretations of a meaning. Remez, the allegoric meaning through allusion, would be part of that in Hebrew, which means hint.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Derash in Hebrew is inquire or to seek, and in its rabbinic meaning is often used with imaginative comparisons with similar words or verses.
Yeah.
Okay. And finally, sod, which it means secret in Hebrew or mystery, the inner esoteric metaphysical sort of meaning expressed in the Kabbalah. So as we can take a look at these four aspects among this Kabbalistic thought, the Kabbalah is considered to be the followers of a necessary part of the study of Torah. So as Travis, as you mentioned, this has strong connections to Judaism and some of their foundational texts and learned sort of knowledge set comes from the very beginning, strong foundation of Judaism.
Yeah. So again, it's not mainstream Judaism. If you ask a group of Jews to comment on this, several might say it's actually heresy.
I would say that's definitely you're going to come.
That might be the mainstream.
Yeah.
But it is an important part. So even Christian Kabbalists would. There are exceptions, but they would look at the original Hebrew text. So the Hebrew letters and words are you know, have hidden meanings. So there's some exceptions, like some actually would use the Latin. You know, they would apply Kabbalistic principles to the Latin alphabet and that kind of thing. But even Christian Kabbalah would look back and at the Hebrew alphabet. When I read the Zohar, it's still written as rabbis commenting on the Torah. So just like the Talmud is like an interpretation of the Torah.
And you know, and Travis, this actually isn't too far off the path with a lot of religions that will look really deeply into the written words of their foundational part of their religion. We see people doing this with adding numbers in the Bible that might equal something. Yeah, and looking for hidden meanings.
Yeah.
If you look at these four points we just talked about, let's look at the words in the English translation from Hebrew: simple, hence, secret or mystery, and also looking to inquire or seek. You know, those are really meaningful sort of words that come with this.
So I don't want to jump ahead too much, but in the Zohar, they would examine like the sentence structure. They would say, why did he say it, this way and not this way? And then they would have this long, like two-page explanation on why this word comes before this word in a sentence. So they would, you know, the names of God had very distinct meanings. And you know, why did they say Adonai and not the true name of God or something like this? So to kind of break it down a little bit further, there's different branches of Kabbalah, and what we're mostly dealing with is theosophical Kabbalah, whereas there's also meditative Kabbalah or magico-theurgical tradition, like practical Kabbalah. And so again, we're kind of more dealing with theosophical, because we got to pick something to talk about, and we can't be all inclusive here. There's a lot of stuff to go over, and so to narrow our scope even further, we kind of stop after medieval Kabbalah. So there's, you know, Hermetic influence in Christian book Kabbalah, like we mentioned, and then later developments are very interesting. So really trying to decode the Bible. To find out when the Messiah is coming, and Christian Kabbalah does that also, tries to, but we stop there. So that's outside of our scope for this show. So when I read the Zohar, so I read an abridged version, granted, but I read the Zohar cover to cover to try to get some kind of understanding of what this is all about. And so when we talk about all these different hidden meanings, yeah, there's a couple of examples here.
One of those examples is something called the Tree of Sephiroth, which means the Tree of Life, but it means emanations. Emanations are of the 10 attributes in Kabbalah, through which Ein Sof, which means the infinite, reveals himself and continuously creates both the physical realm and the chain of higher metaphysical realms. The term is alternately transliterated into English, and it's known in the singular as Sephira or Sephiria. And so you kind of get an idea of circles here. So basically, when each of the 10 circles is one way God reveals himself.
Yeah. So I'll post a picture of the Tree of Life. I think when you see it, you'll know what I'm talking about. So
circles
imagine,
intersect with each other.
Well, no. So imagine a kind of a tree-looking thing, and with three vertical lines. So you have 10 circles. Each one has a name of God in it. And so in three columns, the middle column is longer, which is where the stem of the tree comes from, right?
Okay.
Yeah, if I show you a picture, you'll
know.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it yet, so I would be very interested to see what it looks like.
But you've seen it somewhere, you know, in some kind of mystical illustrations or something. You know, it's a familiar thing, the Tree of Life. For instance, 10 is important, 7 is important. Numbers in general are very important in the Kabbalah, and there's a bunch of numerology to go along here. But so when God split the sea into seven streams, which is mentioned in Isaiah, those make up the lower seven sephirot, which are associated with like strength, victory. And we talked about this in other episodes also, especially like Ramon Lul. So Ramon Lul took this idea and ran with it. This was part of his divinities of God, which I explained on my website also, if you need a reminder. And that's part of his computer, where he wrote them all on a disk. And when you turn, you know, you see like air, earth, fire, water, and then the 10 dignities of God, and, you know, all those, the attributes of matter, everything. So when God created the world, he created the world with 10 words, right? So hence 10. Then I mentioned that there's three columns. So those are called Gimel Kavin, like three lines in Hebrew, and those are often referred to as the three fathers, like the three columns are, and which are derived from the three mothers. So it has, those are kind of attributed to the three vowels, Vav, Yud, and He.
Now let's take a look at the central column, one of the three columns that we're talking about with these associations. The Kether heads the central column of the tree, which is known metaphorically speaking as the pillar of mildness, and it's associated with the Hebrew letter Aleph, which means the breath, the air element, if you will. It is a neutral one, and it's a balance between the two opposing forces of the male and the female tendencies. We talk sort of kind of like the yin and the yang, the balance there. Some teachings describe the Sephorot as a center pillar, as gender neutral, while others say that the Sephorot vary in the sexual attributions. So there is kind of a basic theme here when you talk about the central column being the thing that binds the other two columns together in some ways, and would make this probably more neutral or mild would be the takeaway from this one.
Yeah. So there, on the right column, kind of like the pillar of mercy is what you could call it in English, and it's associated with the Hebrew letter Shin, or also the fire element, kind of like that's the male side basically. And then the left column, obviously the female side, it's so on top is Bina or Binah, and it's called the pillar of severity, which is associated with the Hebrew letter Mem, the water element also, and the female aspect. It, not to say that each circle on those pillars is necessarily male or female. So it's just kind of, you know, generally speaking, those columns is how it breaks down. But some would consider that only the Binah and the Malkut are considered female, while all the others, Sephirot, are male. There's different interpretations depending on which text you're looking at. But in both Jewish and Hermetic Kabbalah, each Sephira is seen as a male in relation to the following Sephirot in succession on the tree, and female in relation to the foregoing Sephirot. So it goes, you know, descending order, like, you know, more male as you go down. Yeah, again, many interpretations. Okay, but obviously this is kind of one of the cores I want to get to, is that there's also numerological sense of the tree of Sephirot, right? There's a lot of numbers that have significance here.
And you're right, the significance is pretty powerful. Between the 10 Sephirot runs 22 channels or paths which connect them, a number which can be associated with the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Again, no mistake there. Together, the spiritual forces of the 10 Sephirot and the 22 connecting channels are called the 32 paths of wisdom. To envision this tree, consider each of these 10 spheres as being concentric circles, with Milkuth being the innermost and all the others encompassing by the latter. None of these are separate from the other, to give you a further bit of an idea of this, and all simply help to form a more complete view of the perfected whole. So to simply speak and say this, Milkuth is the kingdom which is the physical world upon which we live and exist. The Kether, also known as the Kether or the Kether Elon, is the crown of the universe. Mm-hmm. Right, now we're kind of getting pretty deep here on this one, representing the highest attainable understanding of God that men can possibly understand.
Which sounds very much like trying to understand the form of God, like the Neoplatonic. Yeah. So
very much so.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of overlapping ideas here. Okay, so for instances, to give you an example from like Genesis 1, so how they would break this down. So the mothers represent the three times Genesis states God made, right? So God made a man, God, you know, like in his image, God made, you know, every time in that chapter they say God made, that's kind of the mothers. The doubles represent the seven times Genesis states God saw, like, and God saw it was good, right? And then the elementals or singles represent the rest of the times God, like Elohim in every instance of Genesis 1, is mentioned. So again, they, you know, they have these 10 circles, and each one, or there's a couple of them that have, just depending on what words are in Genesis 1, and these have significant, like, deeper meanings.
To understand something, sometimes the imam or the priest or the preacher or the rabbi will put things in a historical context, so you can better understand these words. Does that happen here in Kabbalah as well?
Okay, but we're talking like very esoteric meanings. So not, yeah, forget about the historical context. Mm-hmm. We're talking like describing every Hebrew letter, word, number associated with the letter or the word, even the accent on words. That's important. Like even the accent of the words, I mentioned sentence structure earlier. Every letter or word, they're talking about a spiritual dimension with, you know, deep esoteric ideas associated with each phrase and, you know, just like the part of the sentence, like where it says God made or God saw. So they count those, you know, and then, I mean, it's just, and then all these combinations of those, just like it says, you know, there's seven times Genesis states God saw. So that's obviously important. Yeah. So a lot of context and a lot of like overthinking this.
So translation is extremely important here. What I'm thinking from my religious background, that there's a big rift between people that don't like the or don't appreciate the King James version of the Bible because there's a translation difference in some words from the Greek and also the Hebrew.
So that wouldn't
fly.
Yeah, right. Because so to get that the correct numerical value, it has to be the original Hebrew. Now there's a whole call it a system. I don't want to call it a field of study, but there's a whole system called gematria or gematria, depending on you know how it's translated. It's basically assigning a numerical value to a word or a phrase. If you have two different phrases and they each have the same numerical value, then there could be some relation to each other. Even if it doesn't seem like it, if you read the two phrases, there might be something totally different, but if the numerical value is the same, there's some relation. So obviously there's a lot of interpretive possibilities on, you know, what those that relation is. Then again, it could apply to a person's age, anything with a number in it, you know, so it could be the calendar year, anything like that. So even though the term is Hebrew, it probably comes from the Greek geometria, like geometry, right, which was used as a translation of gematria. So some scholars believe that it kind of derived from Greek grammateia, like, so they're both kind of Greek words, like, you know, grammar in a way. Grammateia and geometria had an influence on the formation of the Hebrew word. Now we're already getting into like Hellenistic times and you know, some of the etymology of the system, but I don't want to get into it too much, but like some people we mentioned, like Giovanni Pico della Mirandola. We haven't done him yet.
We haven't done him. You and I have talked about him in research.
I have one of his books.
Right.
So he's a Christian Kabbalist. So he clearly got it from Greek, but he's still analyzing Jewish texts. One of the best known example maybe is, just to kind of give you one discrete example, is the Hebrew word chai, which means life. So it's composed of two letters, and those two letters add up to 18. And this has made 18, just that fact, has made 18 a lucky number in, you know, Jewish circles, some Jewish circles. And so sometimes you might give gifts in multiples of 18, for instance.
That's a lot of gifts.
Yeah, well, maybe it's 36 cents. I don't know.
okay.
I know that was a very shallow, flat introduction to Kabbalah. There's a lot of stuff there. We're going to go a little bit deeper when we talk about Christian Kabbalah and some of the... Because Christian Kabbalah had... There were Jewish alchemists, and we will do a podcast on them at some point. But the ones that I'm more familiar with at the moment are Christian Kabbalist alchemists. Before we end this podcast, so I did read the Zohar, and the disclaimer I want to say before we go over some of my speaking notes is there are a lot of interesting things that struck me when I read it, but I don't necessarily know, like I've never read the Talmud, so I don't necessarily know what part is not mainstream Jewish philosophy or theology and what part is. So I'm going to, we're kind of going to go over some interesting parts of the Zohar. If you're more familiar with Judaism, then you might recognize some of this stuff from mainstream stuff. So that's not to say this is all esoteric, weird mysticism, but just some of the interesting points, I would say, that I got from the Zohar.
And some of these points have some, they ring a bell across several different religions. For instance, when we say, when God said, "Let there be light," He wasn't talking about the light of day, as one might normally read literally from the Bible, but more talking about His wisdom, which we see in the many esoteric traditions, or even the what we call the Enlightenment.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so God gave the light to Adam, so he could see everything. To David, Solomon, and Moses, but hid it from all others. It basically reinterprets the creation story in Genesis very differently. So the separation of light from darkness is the creation of esoteric knowledge that is not available to everyone.
Yeah.
So again, different religions are going to teach different things. The literal translation, a figurative idea, you know, those type of things. So the Zohar has its own viewpoint.
So the Zohar is written like conversation between two or three rabbis always. It's almost like when Plato wrote about, you know, Plato never put himself in the stories. He was always writing about Socrates arguing with somebody else. So the Zohar is kind of like that. So you always have like two rabbis kind of sharing their wisdom with each other, and they come to conclusions. And so, yeah, it's really interesting stuff. Another example is a couple of rabbis are sitting around, and they break down the word Adam. So the first man. So they say, okay, it's spelled Aleph, Dalet, Mem. So in the Zohar, these are the cardinal directions that made man. So the word Adam is broken down into its Kabbalistic meaning of cardinal directions, like at least east, west, and then one. So one woman. And by the way, who was the first woman according to Jewish mysticism?
Well, that wouldn't be Eve. It would be Lilith.
Yeah.
Right, so I'm not very familiar with the word the personification of Lilith, but this is where the Zohar actually goes with the first woman.
Yeah, they do mention Lilith in the Zohar, and it's also mentioned not just in Kabbalistic texts. This is also, it's not in the Bible, but it is in pretty mainstream kind of Jewish stories. We're not going to break down Lilith's story. It's very cool. I would highly recommend just go to Wikipedia and look up Lilith. It's another example is, for instance, in Deuteronomy, it mentions that God is a pillar of fire. Yet elsewhere, it's mentioned that we should embrace him. Okay, so these are obviously very opposing ideas of God. So this starts a discussion on the nature of fire, that there is consuming and pure fire. Like when you look at a candle, you see that the top white fire is burning on top of blue or red or black, you know, depending on what you're burning. That which in turn is burning the wick. Okay, so likewise, this is like a, you know, pages and pages of discussion. But so they talk about how fire represents hidden wisdom. So that you have what's on top, but it's not actually consuming anything. It's burning other fire, which is on the bottom, which is consuming stuff. So just the layers of, I mean, they just go off on this. Another one is the name of God, which is, you know, if you write it with English letters, it's YHVH. And that represents the stages of ever-increasing divine manifestation. So there's also colors associated with the letters. And those are in the Zohar compared with the stages of fire, for instance. Yeah, I mean, so there's just so many hidden meanings and different interpretations. Again, so then there's a couple of chunks where they look at one specific sentence and say, why is it written this way and not, an alternative way? And so then they scrutinize just the sentence structure for deeper meaning, which, you know, we mentioned before.
And I can see, Travis, the alchemical sort of basis about how this connects to the podcast tonight. This is a religious sort of viewpoint on things, and I think a lot of our listeners might be saying, okay, well, walk me down the path here. How is this related to alchemy? Well, all these shows that we've been doing have – this type of thought of taking something, tearing it down to its base elements, and trying to put it back together to say, okay, what does this mean? How can we get from point A to point B to point C to make this, that, or have this kind of consciousness awareness? And this is happening here when we're talking about this Kabbalah.
Yeah, even any, not all, but several alchemical texts are a good example of writing one thing and meaning something completely different. So they almost tried to imitate in many ways this kind of, you know, esoteric writing where, you know, you're reading the red phoenix does this and this, but you're not talking about that at all. You're talking about mercury or some element or something completely different. Even when they write mercury, they might mean different things. So I think taking these ideas of writing in an esoteric way. So, oh yeah, there's definitely a connection, and we'll get into it at a future podcast. But
let's take a look at this. You know, when we talk about the soul is likewise broken into three parts and compared to the flame, like we talked about. Mm-hmm. Abraham's story is retold in this way as an example of of where he received the parts of the soul and eventually God's wisdom. When death is close and you're about to die, you stop dreaming. And sometimes you don't even see the shadow when you pray. And before I go any further with this concept, Travis, you and I talked about this the other day, that there's a belief system in here that in Judaism that before you die, you see what?
Yeah, the angel of death starts to follow you around.
Right. It could be a couple weeks or a couple days before you're supposed to
pass
away.
Yeah, even like your dead relatives and your father, you'll see your dad. And eventually your relatives will take you to the next place. There's a couple of interesting things. So I did ask a Jewish buddy of mine about the soul in the three parts, because I've never heard that before. And he said, oh, yeah, that's pretty mainstream. Like, they actually – and there's even a I wouldn't want to show a cause and effect here, but there's – you know, in Neoplatonism, there's clearly like the world soul, and then you have your own soul. And when you die, your own soul goes back to the world soul. I'm not saying one came from the other, but so the Zohar breaks down, and even I guess some Jewish mainstream beliefs break down the soul into three parts, and they go into great detail about how they split down and how they break apart, and then when you die, what happens to those three parts? And yeah, so the rabbis are talking, and back to the angel of death thing. So they're talking at one point, and he's like, "Oh man, I've been seeing my dead relatives all day.
That can't be a good sign."
Yeah, that's not good. And the angel of death has been following me around. And so the other rabbi goes, okay, so come in the house quickly. And then even though the other rabbi can't see the angel of death, he says, okay, anybody that's not invited in this house cannot come in. Almost like vampires, right? You got to invite him in. So the angel of death is standing outside the front door. And the rabbi that should be dying doesn't die right then and there. And he's saying, like, yeah, I prayed today, but I didn't see my shadow. And
it sounds kind of like a waiting game that you're probably going to lose.
And another thing, this I asked a buddy of mine, and he said that in kind of mainstream Judaism, there's a lot of emphasis on your daily ritual and prayers. And in the Zohar, like they mentioned praying at midnight, and there's a lot of ritual. And I guess that's pretty mainstream, but. What isn't given that much thought in kind of mainstream Judaism is the afterlife and what happens when you die. And there's a lot of emphasis in the Zohar on that. So that could be a difference. I don't actually know. I'm not an expert there. But that could be a difference. So that actually they say one thing that depending on how good of a life you lived, you know, how much you seeked wisdom, how much you tried to understand God and all those things, that then depends on your actual dwelling in the afterlife. So they actually describe that in when you go to heaven, they say, okay, you're a good rabbi, you've been doing this and this and this, so don't worry, I've seen your abode in heaven, and you'll have windows on four sides, so you'll have lots of light coming in, and, you know, light having a deeper meaning there, and so it's really interesting, it's like he's like describing his house in heaven, which, you know, I think mainstream Judaism don't give that a lot of thought, or at least not a lot of emphasis. And then another thing was saying that this was kind of gruesome, but also interesting, that if you live a bad life, so when you die, your soul is stuck in your body for a while. But depending on how bad you were is when it gets released. So Jews and also Christians believe that when you're buried, at some point in the future is the day of judgment, and God will bring all the bodies, you know, everybody back to life, and you'll be back in pristine condition, which is why cremation can be heretical in certain cases. So you need to preserve the body and bury it and so forth. But in the Zohar, they say, okay, but if you're a bad person, your soul's stuck there for a while, and you feel the decay. And they even mention, like, up to a month, like, you're stuck in your body, and as you're decaying, and they kind of go into some detail there, which, yeah, I'm not going to go into right now.
It makes me want to stay, like, on the right path.
Yeah, so you're stuck
alive
in your body, and you're right. You're feeling this for up to 30 days, and then your soul's released.
That's a pretty bad punishment.
So, yeah. So it was pretty interesting. There was a lot of emphasis on that. I pick and chose very few parts out of a pretty interesting book, and it's not a hard read. So if you're interested in kind of the Kabbalistic canon, you know, one of the basic books, read the Zohar. It's pretty interesting stuff. We will get into Christian Kabbalah, and that's a much thicker book I need to get through. So that's that'll be interesting. And this Mirandola guy is the one that wrote it. So yeah, he was also an alchemist and had some thoughts there. But they basically used the Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic system, to prove that Jesus was the Messiah. So they break down the Hebrew name of Jesus and you know, give it that numerological system, and they break down the word Messiah, and they say, hey, look, you know, here you go. There's your proof right there. And this was also done by Ramon Lull to, you know, he actually engaged rabbis and said, hey, look, you know, we have a lot in common, and pretty interesting stuff. So we didn't really tie it to alchemy this time, but this is the foundation to do it next time. So, yeah, I appreciate you listening, and I hope you found this as interesting as we did, and thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Have a good night.
You've been listening to the History of Alchemy podcast with Travis Dow and Pete Coleman. For more information about this episode, and other information about alchemy, alchemists, and related subjects, visit historyofalchemy.com. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, review, and don't forget to rate us. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments, ideas, and corrections to podcast@historyofalchemy.com or get in touch via Facebook on the History of Alchemy podcast page or Twitter at Alchemy Podcast. Tune in to our sister podcast all about the Czech Republic, Bohemicon, which is also available on iTunes or on bohemicon.com. Until next time on the History of Alchemy podcast, thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.